This is Robert Boudet, author of Competing on Thought Leadership, How Great B2B Companies Turn Expertise into Revenue, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection in with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Robert Boudet to talk about his book, Competing on Thought Leadership, How Great B2B Companies Turn Expertise into Revenue, published by Idea Press. Since the late 1980s, Robert Boudet has been regarded as a pioneer in the theory and practice of thought leadership, well before the concept became widely adopted and loosely interpreted. He and his team at his firm, Boudet Thought Leadership Partners, LLC, collectively bring decades of experience in helping business-to-business companies become widely recognized and richly rewarded for their expertise. His two firms, Bloom Group and Boudet, have provided thought leadership strategy, content development, and marketing services to such companies as Deloitte, Accenture, Ernst & Young, Microsoft, CSC, and a range of smaller B2B firms. He's helped clients develop and publish dozens of opinion articles in the world's most prestigious business and management publications, including Harvard Business Review, Forbes, MIT, Sloan Management Review, Financial Times, Bloomberg, Business Week, and many others. He's also helped several clients conceptualize, develop, and publish best-selling books. And, interesting fact, it took him 22 years to get to his first date with his wife. Robert, congratulations on competing on thought leadership and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas. It's great to be here.
So I see on LinkedIn you go by Bob Boudet. May I call you Bob?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. So also, I should mention, this is important because I keep track of trivia like this on my guests. You are a Penn State grad and not the first. I've also interviewed your fellow alumna, Wendy Pease, and So your wife, you knew her at Penn State, and then you all married different people, but ultimately, you finally figured out that she was the one you should have married because she was your best friend at Penn State?
Well, I knew that she was the one to marry back at Penn State in 1974. I just wasn't looking for a wife at the time.
So. Oh, okay.
So I passed her up, although don't tell her that.
I think she may know that you were married to someone else.
Yes.
But if you haven't told her that, I realize the time may not be right. But yeah, so for you younger people, pay attention to your feelings. Get out there and listen to these things. So now, of great interest to me, you started your career as a business journalist or sports journalist or both?
It was actually as a sports journalist back in 1978 at a small California newspaper called the San Clemente Sun Post. And that's, of course, that is the town where the Richard Nixon had his Western White House. That's where he lived when he wasn't in D.C.
Yeah. Did you ever see him around town?
I never did. I never did. He, he had a lot of security in his Western White House, and so it was hard to. He was probably surrounded by bodyguards.
Right. And I think I recall that he ended up living on the East Coast for much of his post-presidency, like in New York or New Jersey. So
yes, I think that's right.
Yeah. So your book is extremely well written, and you know, as I was reading through it and towards the back, you mentioned that you started as a business journal. I said to myself, I knew it. I knew it. There's something about a book written by somebody who actually had to write for a living. And as the former journalists really do write the best books. So I really appreciate that. It was extremely well written, well paced. You have a lot of expressions in here that I'm going to be stealing with full attribution, of course. And sure. I should add that the book is endorsed by a number of people, including Jeffrey Moore, author of Crossing the Chasm. And he wrote, it's an essential guide to the engine that drives the early adoption of disruptive innovations, which is a a blurb that only Jeffrey Moore, I mean, you could tell if you've read Jeffrey Moore's book, Crossing the Chasm, you know that this really struck him as being exactly what's needed. So I had to laugh on page 23. You mentioned that marketing today requires both Don Draper creativity and Albert Einstein science. And I chuckled to myself because every once in a while I hear from someone who, and I know I may be sounding kind of mean here, but I think they're maybe a little cynical or they're lazy, and they're saying, Douglas, you know, you've read, you know, between 400 and 500 of these sales and marketing books, which I love doing. Are you still learning anything? Are you, you know, what's the point? And it's almost like they're wanting me to say, yeah, don't read books. It's a waste of time. But this book brought to mind the quote from attributed to Einstein, where he said, the more I learn, the more I realize how much I don't know. And that's why I keep going here, because there's the more I read, the more I learn, I don't know, and I feel like I've got to catch up. And that was certainly the case here. I think this is the first book that has been on the show out of, I don't know, nearly 400 that has the word thought leadership in the title. But I learned so much, and I'm embarrassed I didn't know it, but doggone it, we're going to talk about that. And so yeah. I hope that other folks, I think you in the book you mentioned there's like 500,000 people on LinkedIn who have the word thought leadership in their bio. So
yes.
It's yes,
it's like thought leadership is the has become the full employment act, you know, if you have it on your, as project management was, right, 10 years ago.
Right. So
if you have that on your, in your job description or your title, then, you know, you can get a job anywhere.
Yeah. Years ago, I interviewed Sean Ellis about his book, Hacking Growth, which is a fantastic book on growth hacker marketing. And I learned so much from that book, and afterwards I would run into somebody who has the term growth hacker in their LinkedIn bio, and secretly I want to say, really? Have you read that book? Or somebody who claims that they're a storyteller. You know, it's like, well, I don't know. Some of them really are, but it's something that's easily – or it's like a claiming that you're a keynote speaker. And it really drives the real keynote speakers crazy when people put it on there and they're really not paid to be giving talks. But anyway, enough of that. Let's stay positive here. I want to read a couple things from the prologue on page four, or for the listeners in Rome, it's page IV. The label thought leadership is slapped on blog posts, white papers, research reports, sections of websites, and many other things that turn out to be, upon inspection, not highly thoughtful. Many professional services firms might become enamored of the idea of being regarded as thought leaders. Some, in fact, get very good at developing big ideas and even better at marketing them. But that's all they get good at. They are still failing to adopt all of the practices that underpin genuine thought leadership and help them turn it into revenue. From the research-driven data that supports the big idea to the marketing that showcases it to influencers and potential clients, to the capability improvements that enable the company to meet the surge in demand for its services, this book will explore these dimensions of thought leadership. We'll examine how companies can generate demand for and supply of their expertise so they don't turn into shooting stars that fade away. If you lead a professional services or other B2B firm or serve as a C-suite executive at one, or if you are a consultant or a research or marketing specialist in these sectors, this book is for you. And then moving on to page six, I want to quote where it says, after more than three decades in the thought leadership marketing profession, I've seen B2B firms codifying, creating demand for, and generating supply of big ideas for improving other businesses play itself out time and again. There have been other precedent-setting concepts, customer loyalty management, disruptive innovation, blue ocean strategy, lean startup, and emotional intelligence, to name just a few. And along with these standout concepts, a lot of useless debris calling itself thought leadership is now floating around in the vast cosmos of business ideas. The quest for thought leadership has become a crowded stage. But I need to pause here because I've loosely thrown around the term thought leadership that's central to this book. To follow my thinking on this subject requires understanding my definition of it. There are many other definitions out there, most of which only discuss demand creation pieces of the elephant. And then on Page two, you write, the most troubling aspect of the thought leadership profession today is that even when a firm can offer proven ideas, it may not have the capacity to deliver when potential clients find them. So, Bob, what is thought leadership? What should people rewire their brains to know about thought leadership?
So thought leadership is, as you can tell, is not just a marketing activity. Yes. It is something marketing has to be actively involved in. But my definition of thought leadership is as follows. It's the acclaim or eminence that a company or even a nonprofit, it could be, or an individual achieves by getting known for having superior expertise that solves a complex problem. Okay, and that in my definition of thought leadership, I've confined that to a B2B context. Mm-hmm. Although I guess it doesn't necessarily have to. But my experience in thought leadership is with B2B companies. So you know, when you think about it, it's about becoming known for providing superior expertise that solves a complex problem. Then it's the expertise, the marketing of the expertise is only a piece of it. You actually have to deliver superior expertise and get known for that expertise actually working with your clients.
Right, right.
You know.
Yeah, and that there's a line in your book where you say, I'm not going to ride in your spaceship if you haven't test flown it first. I loved it. Yeah. But you know, I think the most important word there was providing superior expertise. It's one thing to talk about it, which so many can do, but can you actually do that? I wanted to go actually to the next page here, page three. Can you talk about the firms that have gained substantial and sustainable market advantages through thought leadership? They excel in just a few areas. There's a few things they all get right. Can you talk about those?
Sure. And there are four of them. The first is what we would call thought leadership strategy. They say they have a small number of what we call client problems in the world that they want to own, not many, and they become deep experts. They say, those are the client problems we're going to solve for the foreseeable future. We want to be known as the leading experts in solving those problems. So that's number one. That's under thought leadership strategy. The second, then, is that they create groundbreaking expertise or groundbreaking ideas about how to solve those client problems that they've decided to own. Mm-hmm. And the way I've seen this work best is, and you can see it through the eminence of people like Clay Christensen and Michael Hammer, the father of reengineering, and Jim Collins, especially Jim Collins, the author of Good to Great and Built to Last and other books, is that they conduct primary research that essentially gleans what's different from companies that are succeeding at the issue at hand, what differentiates them from companies that are failing or struggling on those issues. And from that research, they learn, well, here's what companies at large need to do to solve this particular issue. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's an R&D process in a professional services or other B2B company. Mm-hmm. That can lead to big ideas, to quote unquote thought leading ideas. Then, of course, and this is where the third thing is about turning that content from research and development into material for marketing and sales. So this is where most of the discussion about thought leadership has been centered. About, well, how do we write a book?
Or they start with step three.
Yeah, they start with step three. It's like, okay, we don't need research. We have two client examples, and this consultant of ours, he's a pretty good writer. We'll just let him, you know, send a submission to Harvard Business Review. Mm-hmm. Now, Harvard Business Review, and I've heard this from editors there over the year, they get hundreds of submissions a year, and they reject more than 90% of them, unsolicited submissions. So most of those submissions, I remember one editor told me, and she had the unfortunate job at the time of being the person who had to send the rejection letters out at Harvard Business Review. And she once said to me, she was also a dear friend, she said, many times I can't even figure out what the author or the, you know, the would-be author is trying to say. I don't even know what argument he or she is trying to make here. So I just have to reject it on that basis.
Yeah.
That there may be something in there, but she doesn't have the time to help figure it out. Okay, so that's about thought leadership, marketing, and sales. And then the fourth thing is about, and this is what I call the supply side of thought leadership. So you can have a best-selling book, you can have a classic Harvard Business Review article, you can have an idea that changes the world based on your research, but if you can't scale up the delivery of that expertise, you will have created a nice market for your competitors to take away from you if, in fact, they can ramp up their people, train their people, you know, about how to solve the problem that you've outlined how to solve in your book. And my case in point here is the firm I worked for in the first 10 years of my career in thought leadership, a firm called CSC Index. And we set the world on fire back in the early 90s with a concept which was the blockbuster management concept of the 90s called business reengineering. Don't automate, obliterate your your siloed organization. And we went from $40 million in revenue when I joined the company in 87 to $200 million about 8 years later. By 95, so 40 to 200 million in 8 years. And then at the end of the decade, that 200 million went to zero. Okay? So the rise and fall, as I've called it, the rise and fall on the sword of thought leadership.
And I was going to say they didn't blow it all on a Christmas party or something.
Well, some of the Christmas parties, you might have suspected that they held.
Yeah, but this is such a great example of not getting that fourth point right.
Oh, it's the classic example, and I've seen it play out in many other ways. Which is, you know, it's almost like your marketing capabilities and your sales capabilities outstrip your internal methodology and internal training and development capabilities, and so. It was firms like Accenture in the mid-90s and Deloitte, which had big investments in internal training and development and in internal methodology development. They were the ones who ran away with the market for business reengineering. Mm-hmm. You know, I liken it to telling your soldiers the war's over there. You'll figure out how to use the weapons. You know, when you're out there, you'll figure out how to drive a tank or shoot a rifle. You don't need any training. You'll figure it out. Well, CSC Index was not as bad as that. We had some internal training and development. Maybe it was a matter of we didn't really understand how big an idea reengineering was going to become.
Okay, that's fair.
And so we didn't commit the resources to internal method development and training and development. I think the feeling may have been we don't have to. We're doing great. The orders are coming through the door.
Yeah.
You know? People are coming to us. They want to be reengineered. And unfortunately, our competitors invested a heck of a lot more in the supply end of thought leadership, and they took the market.
But let's get back to this marketing problem, as I call it. Actually, it was very next page four, you write, marketing and sales, i.e. demand creation, are just one of the four pillars, okay, of the ones that Bob just talked about. But if you've read the more than 30 books on thought leadership over the last 20 years, as Bob has, I don't know, you probably skimmed some of them, you'd think that's the only thing about thought leadership. Why does that happen?
Why does that happen? I'm not sure what the answer is. I think it's easier to market. The hardest thing is to come up with a big idea. The hardest thing is thought leadership, as I call it, research and development. You know, the number of blockbuster ideas out there, management concepts, very small number. It's much easier to market and sell a big idea than it is to develop methodology and train people on how to deliver that idea. And the it also may be due to the fact that, and we mentioned this with the CSE index example, when business is just rushing through the door, it's easy to get lulled into thinking that we must be gods, you know? We're the pioneers of this new concept. People have to come to us. They want to come to the originators of the idea. You know, they don't want to go to the, you know, the copycats. Well, guess what? If the copycats are actually implementing the idea better than your company, guess where the customers are going to go?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's it reminds me of you know, the first mover advantage in business, or maybe the myth of it. You don't necessarily have to be the first. You know, Apple was not the first one to come out with an MP3 player. They took that technology and ran with it. So thought leadership has been around for a long time, I think you could argue, but what is it that has given it such traction since the 1990s?
I think the internet has been an accelerant. You know, in the when I started in this business, the way you got your ideas out to market was you printed magazines and you mailed them, you know, or newsletters. You printed newsletters and you mailed them. And so now it's so easy just to post things online and have a global audience. So it's a lot easier to publish, quote unquote, thought leadership, or to publish content, period. And so more people have jumped into the game saying, oh, we, you know, we can do that too. But I also think it's more important. It's that many B2B companies, especially in the consulting and IT services sectors, their clients have been demanding them to show their expertise, you know, to show us, you know, show us an article that you wrote, or do you have anything in Harvard Business Review that you've published, or have you guys published a book on this topic? Because somebody else usually has. And so it's, as I say in the book, it's the world has become much more complex. Executives in B2B companies who are looking for consultants or law firms or even architects to redesign their office building, or design a new office building, they have increasingly, these decisions are higher stakes. The consulting firm you bring in could wreck your business, right? The law firm you bring in could give you bad advice and cost you a lot of money. So there's more complexities in business. There's certain decisions that are higher stake decisions these days. And so the customers, the consumers, put it that way, of thought leadership have more riding on big strategic decisions. And so one of the ways to kick the tires of law firms or consulting firms or architects or IT services firms, one way to kick the tires of, do these folks really know what they're doing, in addition to talking to the referrals that they've been given by these firms, is to read their publications, to attend their conferences. Let's see how these people think. And if we agree with how they think about the problem that we might give them to solve, then we'll feel a lot better about having a discussion with them that could lead to giving them the business.
And the problems are increasingly complex, and it seems like the velocity of new problems is only picking up. So problems now some companies are wrestling with, that probably wasn't even an issue 5 years ago in certain instances.
Sure. Case in point, the metaverse, right? I'm still trying to figure out what it is. And I bet you I'm serious. I think a lot of business executives are too, trying to figure out. I know Zuckerberg and Facebook are talking about metaverse, but I have no idea how this relates to our business and what we could do differently, and what problem in the world that we have this could help us solve.
Yeah, it's like I can remember in the 1990s, so working at a big agency in New York, and you kept hearing about this internet thing. And they assigned a couple of executives, said, just go figure this out. We don't know what to do with it, but we need you to help help us figure it out so that we might be able to help our clients. Similar sort of sort of thing. There may be people looking at crypto now, the same sort of thing, trying to understand how it might work for their business. So
yes.
I want to go on to quote something from page 14, which actually is a question. You write, there's no question that thought leadership has become a white hot field. The signposts are everywhere. The question might be, why? Why are so many people in so many companies and B2B sectors trying to communicate their expertise in articles, speeches, seminars, webinars, blog posts, books, and their own Harvard Business Review-looking company management journals? So we've touched a bit on that, like why companies are so hungry for thought leadership. And one of the things that interested me is where you said that in 1975, 83% of the S&P 500 company assets were tangible, like property, plant, and equipment, I guess. And in 2020, only 10% of assets are tangible.
Right.
That just amazed me.
It is amazing, isn't it? The intangible assets, I guess you could call thought leadership an intangible asset, right?
Yeah.
But I think they're really talking about other stuff there.
Yeah.
That is a statistic. And by the way, I'm looking at, trying to search on what page.
Oh, it's on page 18. And that for was, those playing the home game. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let me, because we've touched on some of why there's such a demand for thought leadership. Let me ask you this. You write, simply proclaiming that a company has expertise in an advertisement or on the golf course isn't enough anymore. Proclaiming such expertise through ads, trade show booths, sales brochures, and slick website pages that describe a company's services and products works only when those products and the problems they solve are not complex. So then you go on to write on page 29, I've seen many B2B companies get confused about when they need image, product, and thought leadership marketing. Can you explain this interesting grid that you have on that page in terms of when it's right to do the different types? In other words, it has to do with the complexity of the problem and the complexity of the solution.
That's right. So this is a framework I developed with two colleagues of mine back in the late 90s, and which made it in a Harvard Business Review article, but it actually the image didn't make it, but the ideas made it. So think about two axes. One is the complexity of the customer's problem, and the other axis is the complexity of your solution to that problem.
Right.
So what I argued was that when a customer's problem, the complexity is very low, and the complexity of the solution is very low, then the most appropriate form of marketing is image marketing. So,
for like laundry detergent, I want to get my clothes cleaner. I just use that product.
That's right. Or Coke versus Pepsi. You know, mm-hmm. they both quench my thirst. I don't need to understand as a customer what problem of mine that solves. It's not a complex solution. It's Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. right? And so the marketing there, image marketing is, well, you know, give me a nicer emotional feel around that product. Coke is it. Things go better with Coke, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that this is where most of the advertising world, Douglas is you know, your area of expertise. This is where most of the consumer marketing world has been focused for the last, 100 years.
So, right? Yeah. And it worked well.
It worked very
for,
well.
For particular problems and solutions.
Exactly. And David Ogilvy wrote a great book, you know, that propelled back in the early 60s, Confessions of an Advertising Man, that propelled his business by conveying his secret sauce to image marketing, mm-hmm. right? Then there's a little bit higher up the complexity scale in terms of the customer's problem, and higher up the complexity scale of the solution is a zone I call product marketing. So it's marketing on a features and functions basis. Okay, I need to know why Ford's SUV is better than a Toyota SUV or a Nissan SUV or a Mercedes SUV, etc. Give me the feature and function difference. Now, you know, some of the marketing of those vehicles is also done on an image basis, right? Mm-hmm. So Porsche invents its first SUV, the Cayenne, a number of years ago. And they're just a bunch of people who love Porsches and think, oh, a sports car kind of like SUV. Oh, I'd be interested in that. Porsche is about high-end sports cars. Oh, interesting. A sexy SUV. But I would argue they...
That sounds like dad jeans.
Yeah, really. Yeah, dad is having a midlife crisis. Right. So, he's taking the kids out, in his to soccer games in his sexy Porsche.
Trying to relive the dream. That's right.
Exactly. Or divorced dad is trying to do that. So, but most, SUV advertising, from what I have seen, is a product marketing type. We get better fuel mileage, we can tow more. There's a third seat that folds down in the back that you can actually fit seven people comfortably. Okay, that's a feature function basis, right? Or we have higher quality. Look at our consumer reports ratings,
right.
Our vehicles last longer. And then the third zone is for customer problems that are highly complex and the solutions of which are also highly complex. And that I call the thought leadership marketing zone.
Yeah. And this would be the upper right-hand corner of this box we're describing.
That's correct. That's the upper right-hand corner. And, every consulting firm that I know of is selling a complex solution to a complex business problem of an organization. Mm-hmm. Whether it's our quality of our products is terrible, how do we improve quality? That's a complex problem. Or our digital marketing is ineffective. What's the problem there? Are we using the wrong marketing technology? Are our messages crap? Are we doing media buying in a not very efficient way? What's wrong? What's wrong with our digital marketing? Or supply chain, right? Supply chain problem. Why are we suffering so many bottlenecks? How do we make our supply chain work better?
Mm-hmm. So, or human capital.
That's even the most complex. Yeah, right. Right. People are leaving our company. and they're not telling us why. They're saying they had a good time and now they're gone.
Yeah.
So, how do we stem the turnover?
Mm-hmm.
So these are complex problems that that firms that sell complex solutions to them, in the case of the employee turnover, that's a consulting firm is an HR consulting firm is going to be involved there, or could be involved there. And so these are problems that the customer, in that case, in this example, the company suffering from high employee turnover, they are looking for new approaches to solving the problem, and they are really open to people who write really interesting articles or have written books, mm-hmm. or giving a speech at a HR conference that they're about to attend. At that point, those companies are really open to new and proven thinking about how to solve the problem. So an advertisement, to that group saying, We have a better solution to your turnover problem. That might be met with a lot of skepticism. The CHRO, the Chief Human Resource Officer in that company, in our experience, is going to want to read something that consulting firm has written, especially if it's been published in Harvard, a place like Harvard Business Review or MIT Sloan Management Review. Therefore, they know that some of the best thinking goes in these publications, that they sort through stuff, and therefore for this consulting firm to have its article appear in such prestigious publications, it must be good.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a quality check. Same with a keynote speaker who earns his way onto the speaking, platform to give a speech on this. So this is the way complex products and services that solve or address complex problems. This is the most effective way that I've seen them to be marketed.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great framework.
Thank you.
So moving on to the chapter on strategy, I had to laugh, and we may get into this. You explained why automobile manufacturers, which we've already talked about, why they rarely advertise concept cars that are coming several several years down the road, and I want to.
Well, they rarely actually make. They don't advertise them. They show them at the car shows, right?
Okay, yeah.
But they don't make most of them.
Right. Okay.
So they're teasing us.
Yes. Right. Well, yeah. And I think there's something instructive there. You're right. This is about strategy. Many B2B firms have no rhyme or reason as to why certain low revenue parts of their business are making outsized investments in thought leadership, while other higher revenue parts are spending very little. And you go on to write, they're so common, I'm no longer shocked by them. Our research suggests this may be the rule, not the exception. So why does this happen with this such misaligned investments in thought leadership?
In part, it's because thought leadership marketing investments can be under the cover, or you don't really know what's being spent in a multi-region firm, multi-practice firm, where budgets for this kind of stuff are not centralized budgets. They're in an industry practice or a regional practice, a country practice. And so the first people at the top of the company often don't know what the folks out in the hinterlands are spending and on what. Mm-hmm. So if somebody writes an article and is invited to give a speech at a conference and delivers that speech, often the folks at the top don't even know that. They may get a travel expense report back that the folks at the top see. But
why are you going to that conference? And I guess is the problem that they're then stimulating demand for a product that the company's not really ready to deliver?
That could be a problem. The bigger problem I see is that a company can wind up spending kind of surreptitiously far more in marketing services that generate a small proportion of total revenue in the firm, while other practices in the firm are not spending nearly enough to generate more interest in their services. Mm-hmm. And so, unlike a Nestle or a Procter & Gamble, where the folks at the top know exactly how much is being spent by what divisions, and probably even coordinating this with ad agencies, the spending in a professional services firm on thought leadership is often buried and often very unequal, where one service is just a service line is spending too much of the total budget for thought leadership, and another service line is not spending nearly enough.
Yeah, it also seems like ego may be playing a role, like it does for all things humans. But it's like the person, let's say it's an executive, and they enjoy becoming well-known for something. They're spending their own free time or their billable time, yes, becoming more of a thought leader, and they like that. They like how people perceive them, and they want to do that. But the problem is, I think in the book you even mentioned there's some people who get so far up that ladder they say, I don't know, we don't even do it anymore. I just want to be invited to these things to speak, and I want to sell my book.
That's right. They become a rock star, in business, and they enjoy the accolades that come from that, mm-hmm, which can be high speaking fees and other adulation.
Right.
But the job of turning that expertise into a service and then training people internally about how to deliver that service as well as the thought leaders, that often appears to be boring to the thought leaders.
Right, right. Very different skill sets.
Yes.
And you go into that in the book. Let me jump ahead here. You say there's four elements of a thought leadership strategy. Now, these are easy to say, but really difficult for companies. And I'm going to come back to one of these. Yep. You talk about the core problems of target clients that the firm will own. The core problems of target clients that the firm will own. And number two is how the firm will develop exceptional content about solving those core client problems. Three is how to create demand for the firm's expertise. And four, and again, this is the part that I think is so missing for most people's perception of thought leadership, is how to ramp up services that solve those problems. I want to go to the one about target clients' problems to own. And
yes,
you talk about the you need to fall in love with those problems. Explain what you mean there. In other words, there might be 100 problems a company could solve, but they've got to figure out like those that handful of problems, and then they have to really want to stay with it. Can you say more about that?
Sure, and I'll give you an example of a firm we worked with last year. The problems to own are problems of clients that are you believe are not going to go away. You may need to evolve the solutions that you bring against those problems, but those problems are not likely to go away.
Right, they're persistent.
They're persistent. Okay, mm-hmm. So an example: managing large projects in companies, and those projects could be a big software project, right? A systems installation. It could be moving headquarters from one city to another. It could be managing a new drug coming to market, or any new product coming to market. These are problems, you could say project management problems. So we work with a project management firm a year ago on their thought leadership strategy. Great firm. Firm is called Integrated Project Management Company. So for, I think it's roughly 30 years, this is the business problem in the world that they have owned. The how to help their clients manage these big projects, many of which, maybe all of which, there's considerable revenue on the line for their client. Okay, so they have managed, they have been a firm that's been a key partner with many large and small pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies. Those are not their only clients, but they're a considerable set of their clients. Especially in in various stages of the drug development process, where you know you can't have a ball or many balls dropping in the development of a new drug, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of money being committed to the development of new drugs, from the research all the way through clinical trials to rollout. Okay? So the client problem in the world that company owns is we help big companies manage big complex projects and make sure they come in on time, on budget, etc. That's a big problem in the world these days because there are so many complex projects that in which the internal capabilities of companies are often outstripped by the complexity and the demands of the project. So they bring in firms like this one, Integrated Project Management Company.
Right. And so I guess the opposite of a persistent problem, would that be like the Y2K problem?
That's a great example.
20 years ago?
Yeah,
where
it went away.
Yeah, it just went away. So you don't want to focus on problems that are not almost eternal. So I want to jump to another part here, which really gets into the marketing, okay? So marketers really need to listen up here. Ends of page 47, you write, from nearly 40 years of experience, I've seen thought leadership executives spend far more time and money on the content development and demand generation end of thought leadership, and much less on the supply side, developing service offerings or new approaches to existing services. Now, we've talked about that.
Yeah.
But then further down that page, you talk about once you have a sound strategy, you're on a solid path to taking what I call a content-centric rather than a marketing-centric approach to thought leadership. So explain the difference. It may seem subtle to some listeners, content-centric versus marketing-centric.
So, and this may piss off a bunch of marketing people, but
that's why I warned them.
Yeah, but I come from the world of marketing. So, you know, marketers—
We're trying to help here.
Yeah, we're trying to help here. Right. Marketers are critical to thought leadership, but a content-centric approach means, well, if we step back, if a piece of content, quote unquote, thought leadership content, if it is not solid, if it is not, if it doesn't talk about a new idea, with the proof that it actually works. It's the concept is rigorous, et cetera, et cetera. I have 9 criteria of what makes for a high quality idea or content. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't meet those tests, you can throw a lot of money, a lot of money on marketing that idea, and not much is going to happen. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so the greatest gift to marketers is a really robust piece of thought leadership content. Okay, it's the marketer's dream. It was my dream back at CSE Index with re-engineering. I played very little role in the development of that idea. Very little. I would like to think I played a big role in the marketing of that idea. And I remember thinking back at that time that this is a marketer's dream to have an idea that is so new, that has lots of case examples that prove that re-engineering actually had big benefits at big Fortune 500 companies. This is the marketer's dream. So a marketing-centric approach, in contrast, I think is one in which marketers will say, well, the content's good enough. You know, it's not new. We have one case example to prove the solution works, but even the proof is not that great. It's a small improvement in that company's problem. But we need to publish something, right?
You're right. And then we need I could just imagine them calling a marketer into the conference room saying, here, this is what we got. Now, go do that magic marketing thing you do.
Exactly. Right. Right. You know, maybe, I don't know, what is the, Douglas, what is the consumer product equivalent? Is it, is you know, when you're at J. Walter Thompson, is the advertiser comes to you, you know their product stinks. And they're hoping advertising will somehow magically create.
Yes, absolutely. Man. Yeah, I can remember the joke that we would... it was no point in telling them because we'd say, you know, nothing kills a bad product faster than really good advertising. But at that point, they were hoping, you know, it was some sort of Hail Mary pass that they were hoping to take. And they, you know, if we would ever make a suggestion on improving the product, they'd say, yeah, we'll get to that. It wasn't their problem. But, you know, what's so interesting, and this might be something a thought leadership marketer might want to put up on their on the wall of their office, is on page 53. You already touched on it, the 9 elements of exceptional content. And or maybe they could share it with the folks that are developing these things, if not a copy of your book. I was wondering if you could walk through these quickly, what the elements are, because I think when people hear this, they're going to say, ooh, wait a minute.
Yes.
We are missing a few of these.
Sure. Okay. So, you know, the first element is about relevance. Are we addressing a very timely problem for our audience? For our
right. And we've talked about the problem. There's a lot to it. You pick the right problem.
Pick the right problem. Yeah. Right. So what about our solution? This is the second element, novel solution. Do we have a very different way of solving that problem than what others have said in the marketplace?
And is that one of the – that seems like one of the most important things. The novelty.
The novelty and the evidence are the two most important things. Mm, okay. Novelty, really novel solutions are hard to find. Mm-hmm. I typically see incrementally different solutions or not even incrementally different. It's the same solutions that others are peddling. They may put, you know, new labels on old wine, but it's still essentially the same wine. Mm-hmm. So that's novelty. Depth of understanding the problem, you know, show me how much you know about, if I'm the reader, show me how much you know about my problem and how I've tried to solve it over the last few years. And please help me understand why it's not working, because it is not working. I just don't understand why. Okay. So that's, you know, depth of understanding the problem, and depth and showing depth, of course, in the solution as well. Mm-hmm. Then there's we call feasibility, you know, the solution. Is it in the reader's mind, have they shown me enough that I think I can actually implement this in my firm? Or does it sound, you know, this is pie in the sky, this is Shangri-La, it just looks so infeasible that we'll reject it out of hand.
Right.
So, you know, in thought leadership, the way to address that is to is to reveal the key elements or the steps in solving the problem.
Right.
Now, a lot of the pushback I have gotten over the years on this element is they'll say, well, yeah, but if we tell them how to do it, you know, if we lay out exactly how to do it, then they won't call us, right? They'll just do it themselves. And then I remind people, well, look, whole books have been written, right, that are thought leadership. And if somebody can fix your problem by reading your book or your article, you don't have a consulting service. If it's that easy to implement, and it never is, then they don't need you. So,
yeah, just because you have a recipe doesn't make you a chef.
There you go. Right. It certainly doesn't make me a chef.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the fourth element. The fifth is evidence that your superior solution works. So we all can claim we have a new and better solution, but it's the better. If it's new, I still want to know that it actually works.
Have you test flown that spaceship before you want me to get in it?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Tell me how many times. And if it's just once, you know. I remember getting gallbladder surgery 22 years ago, and my general practitioner said, I'm going to refer you to a guy who has done dozens of this surgery through a relatively new technique at the time, laparoscopic surgery. And my GP said, you want to find a guy who's done this dozens of times and that you're not the third patient or the second patient.
Right.
I said, I think you must be right. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
All right, so that's evidence. Illuminating frameworks, that simplify very complex ideas. So that framework that you liked earlier in the book,
yes.
You know, that these three worlds of marketing, you know. Frameworks can do a lot to help make cogent and clear very complex things. So there was a framework in business reengineering that Mike Hammer and others referred to was called the business system diamond. Michael Porter's five forces and mm-hmm. his value chain model, a different framework, you know, they were memorable frameworks that got people to think differently.
And what was it the Boston Consulting Group that had the cash cows? And
yes, it was. It was called the growth share matrix. Yep. Right. Cash cows and your dogs and
right.
et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A great idea of a framework, a great example of a framework
mm-hmm.
That helped put them on the map, by the way, because they were a relatively new consulting firm in the 60s compared to McKinsey.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
And they came out of with frameworks like that, they shot upwards, BCG did. Okay, so the seventh attribute or element of exceptional content is what I call something that's irrefutable. So in the argument you're laying down for some problem in the world and a better solution to it, every aspect of your argument has to be unassailable. The logic has to be bulletproof, okay? The audience, a good portion of your audience is just not likely to buy into it.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the eighth element I say is clarity. You know, can your argument be easily understood by your target audience? So Einstein was once quoted as saying a great physics teacher ought to be able to teach physics to a barmaid, right? Or if you can't explain it to your grandmother, you don't know it well enough. So, you know, clarity and this is why most best-selling business books are ghostwritten by professional writers. It's because the ability, a lot of very smart people have a lot of challenges reversing their thinking and imagining what it is to know nothing about the topic that they're, about to write 50,000 words about.
Yeah, and I should interject, over the years, I've read a fantastic book and interviewed the author, and I knew the book better than the author did. And to the audience, I'd like to say I didn't publish those interviews, so you're welcome, but they could have at least read their own book. So, yeah, but it's true, and they were, oh, boy, they were really well written. I absolutely loved them until I spoke to the, quote, author, and they had probably pretty much only read the news release about the book.
That's right. And it was like, what was that cosmetic back in the 60s? Was it Brill Cream or something? You know, Only your hairdresser knows for sure, right? Well, only your ghostwriter knows for sure.
Right. You know? Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's the clarity of argument. And then the last one is stimulating.
Yes. And that's, you know, give me little known facts that support my argument. You know, intrigue me with some facts I didn't know. And I'm trying to think, you know, in my book, I thought this was intriguing. 500,000 people have thought leadership in their LinkedIn title or job description.
Yeah, it was intriguing enough for even me to mention it.
Yeah.
It really got my attention. That tingling means it's working, Bob.
Oh, there you go. See, it worked.
Yeah. So there's quite a bit in the book about content, but I want to jump ahead to really the two pillars of this, which are you know, primary research you're doing, as well as field experience. Yep. Okay. So let's talk about the research. Explain what you mean. I think it's on page 72 here. You write, perhaps one of the most important things to understand about thought leadership research is that it's not market research. Mm. What's the difference there?
So, and we should get my brother Tom Boudet on this podcast because he's from the world of market research.
Right.
He, you know, he hired a lot of market researchers at Nestle.
Oh, he was at Nestle. Okay. And you're, are you at his house in California right now?
No, he has a house in California.
Okay.
That's grander than the house that we're in.
So
you can see that consumer marketing has been more lucrative than thought leadership. But, and he comes from a market research background. So, you know, I look at market research as the testing that a company must do with a product that it has, you know, to either market it better, you know, why is our messaging not working, or a product that's on the drawing boards to see if there's actually a market for it, right? And what the market, what customers want. That's market research. Thought leadership research is very different, and it can be perceived as the same things. So thought leadership research is business-to-business company's exploration of some problem in the world that it probably already has services in addressing, and looking at how companies have been have been trying to solve this problem through both surveys and case study interviews, phone and in-person interviews with people in those companies, to understand what's the difference between how the best companies at solving this problem, what do they do differently than the companies, than the rest?
Right, like Jim Collins, who you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. That was Jim Collins' research method and has been. These matched pairs of companies, right, where let's look at two companies in the same industry. One has done exceptionally well. The other has done exceptionally poorly, you know. And what's, you know, why? What did company A do that company B did not do?
Right. So when you're doing thought leadership research, an example of the question not to ask is, on a scale of 0 to 10, how much do you love our products and services? Thought leadership research.
That is not thought leadership research.
Yeah, it's exactly. more about the problems and look to Jim Collins. I want to jump now. So that was the research, the whole chapter on that. And then there's another one about field experience, which is you should also be looking. It seems like most companies probably have more of that than they realize. And you write that the key skill in turning field experience into a powerful point of view is not what many people think it is. Great writing skills. What? What? Oh, now we've pissed off even more people. It's argument development. But you go on to write, the biggest mistake companies make when they're trying to capture their unique field-tested client work is thinking that writing articles, blog posts, conference presentations, and white papers should start the process. This is such a great section. You write that they see the process as a prose-making process, collecting the thoughts on the subject experts whose bylines will go on the content and turning them into cogent sentences and paragraphs. They skip the most important step, creating a compelling argument first. Writing prose is a highly inefficient and usually ineffective way to do that. The result, they dive into these writing projects with gusto before they fully develop their argument. That's a recipe for tremendous frustration and precious lost time. The writing in the best books, presentations, and articles is like the finished work on a gorgeous building.
Yes.
But it's the architect who designed the concept and created the blueprints. True thought leadership has the solid foundation of a bulletproof argument supported by strong walls of experience, data, and logic. Can you talk about this idea of getting the argument first? And even specifically, you talk about there's like a document that should be written. It's not necessarily shared, but it forms sort of the cornerstone of everything that comes afterwards, if I've got that right.
Yes, sure. And this is the biggest, one of the biggest missing skills in thought leadership right now. And it's not a skill that if you hire a journalist and you say, we need a journalist in here to write our white papers or write our Harvard Business Review article submissions, it's not a skill that these people bring with them. Most of them do not bring this skill with them. So even the best journalists.
Right. And that's a observation, not a criticism.
Correct. Because they can learn the skill. And mm-hmm. and some of them have, and some of them have done it very well. And I've hired many of them over the years, so, and taught them this. So the ones who are doing this in our business, in fact, I'm teaching a very large professional services firm. I'm in the second of three classes. I'll deliver another class in May where I'm teaching this skill in a virtual classroom. I'm
developing the argument?
Correct.
Okay.
That's what I'm teaching. And I've had to learn this skill the hard way from doing it in the way that I advocate against in the book. And the typical way that an article or white paper or article op-ed submission is written, typical way is your consultants or your lawyers or whatever the professional firm or other B2B firm you are in, they sit down, and maybe there's multiple people whose names will be on the article. They're the authors. They'll sit down with a writer and they'll say something to the effect of over an hour of time or 2 hours of time, they'll say, here's what we want to write. Here's our idea. We have a few examples. Okay, now give us a draft in, you know, a few days or a week. Okay.
Weave your web, Spider-Man.
Yes, that's right. If the people whose names are going to be on there, they're the subject experts. If they think they're going to get a good draft, they're going to be in for a disappointment. So,
and they're going to think it's the writer's fault too.
Oh, sure. And often what happens is the writer will write something that's really that's highly readable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it's not persuasive. It's a nice breezy read, but it's not rigorous. There aren't enough examples to prove the new solution works. The problem statement, like, so what problem is this addressing in our target clients? That's not even understood. It goes right to the solution.
Yeah. I can already hear some of the missing parts from the nine steps that you just mentioned.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And by the way, one of the biggest things we see is the problem statement. Like, who exactly has this problem? What kind of companies? What is the problem? What is the problem? And why does it cost? What's the penalty from not solving the problem? Often, really smart people just jump right past that. They say, everybody knows this is a problem. You know, everybody knows this is a problem.
Back to Einstein, he seems to be playing a supporting role here, but I seem to recall, maybe it was in your book or elsewhere, something about Einstein said, if I had 4 hours to solve a problem, I'd spend the first 3.5 thinking about the problem before trying to solve it or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it was in the book. I've seen that elsewhere. It's like, okay, right.
Well, that's the problem? Time. Sure, we can solve that.
Yeah. Now, when we work with clients on this, we'll often spend the first session or two just defining what the problem is and who has it and why it's a serious problem and what evidence do we mm-hmm. have that it is a problem out there, just to set up the problem. So the biggest problem in taking starting the article development process with prose, with, you know, interview the subject experts all together or sequentially and then write a draft. The biggest problem with that is the argument is not likely to be very good in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
And you also suffer from the not all the authors are saying the same thing, right? I mean, it was Francis Ford Coppola who was once asked, "What was this after The Godfather? What's the secret to making a great movie?" And he said, "The secret to making a great movie is making sure everyone is making the same movie on the set."
Yeah.
I
think that was in the book where he actually defined it for everyone so they could understand sort of what the North Star was.
Yes. Like, this is what this movie is about, right? Mm-hmm. This is our theme. This is the message. And so when there are multiple authors on a piece of thought leadership, you can get into that, can create some very big problems. And them all agreeing on what the problem is and what the solution is, and you got to get people on the same page. So what I've learned to do over the years, and what the firms that I've run over the years have done, is we've separated the argument making from the conveyance of the argument, which is what prose is about.
Right.
So for a 10,000 word white paper, and we've written many of them and some even longer than that, the outline, which is the tool to use to evolve the argument, the outline, because it's a lot easier to change outlines than it is to change prose, mm-hmm. right? The outlines can be longer than the eventual article or prose that follows it.
I found that interesting, but it's all about measure twice, cut once.
Correct.
So yeah, it's very interesting. Again, one of the many things I learned. I want to jump back to marketing, if you don't mind. I forget this is the Marketing Book Podcast, but you know the famous movie "Build It and They Will Come," Field of Dreams.
Yeah,
you know, it's something that a lot of people don't understand. Just because you have the content, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make any noise? Same applies to thought leadership. And you write on page 110, compelling content won't find a substantial audience on its own devices. And great marketing is another piece of the thought leadership formula. So it is very, very important. And there's quite a bit in the book about that. So you write, how does an organization gain eminence after it's created a superior solution to a specific problem? Expertise it has captured and codified in a research report, book, foundational point of view type paper, or some other weighty format, how does it gain the recognition it wants to gain to generate the business that it wants to generate? Can you talk about this concept of the big ripples? It's sure. Another great framework that you have in the book.
So the ripple, I call it the ripples in the pond approach to thought leadership marketing, and the pond being this digital pond of all of ours, right? The internet and email, in which we're increasingly that is the way we get our information, and that is the way we disseminate our information, thought leadership, and other. So, as I say in this chapter, you want to create a substantive concept, you know, hopefully research backed, if not then by substantial field experience with mm-hmm. the problem at hand. When you drop that piece, whether it's a white paper or a conference presentation that you've given, into this quote-unquote digital pond, you have to help the waves. You have to help that content ripple out. And there are, and this is will be nothing new to many or most marketers, but there's owned channels, shared, earned, and paid. So mm-hmm. the owned channels are companies, digital publications. So McKinsey's got McKinsey Quarterly, and PwC has Strategy and Business. So Tata Consultancy Services, which has been one of our biggest clients, they have their version of McKinsey mm-hmm. Quarterly, called TCS Perspective. So that's a channel we own.
So it could be printed. It could be your website. Your email list would be owned.
Could be your email list. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And okay. Email newsletters that go out, could be seminars that you run, webinars that you run. McKinsey, for example, is running a lot of webinars for its clients and prospects, invitation only, live webinars, in over the last 2 years because of the pandemic, and they're typically very well attended. So that's it. Those are channels that that you control, that your firm controls. Okay, but. Typically, unless you're McKinsey and you have, you know, a million or more people who subscribe, who read your your online publication, McKinsey Quarterly, most firms don't have that kind of readership.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the readership that Harvard Business Review does, which I think the last time I checked was 4 million unique viewers or something like that. You know, incredible. And Forbes, I think, has something like 50 million unique viewers. So that gets to shared content. So if we, meaning we're sharing, so LinkedIn is a great example of shared content. So we post the same article that we posted on our site, we post it as a LinkedIn post. Well, that gets it to more people, mm-hmm. right, who may not be looking at our website. That pushes the same content out a little further. It's getting it on the web. Getting a piece of content on the web, Google, you know, will at some point, probably quickly, its web crawlers will recognize that content. And if you have enough, depending on what Google's formula is at a certain point in time, if enough people are clicking on your article or you know, taking your article link and putting it on their site, Google then will, when somebody types in supply chain bottlenecks in Asia, and you have a paper on that, then over time, Google will, when somebody types that in, Google will bring your white paper up, you know, higher on its results list.
Mm-hmm.
So that's shared content. We're sharing some other, it's typically social media or Google. You know, our content is being, we're putting it out there for other people to see. On other platforms. Earned content are things where you can't pay for play, right? It's you,
like the Harvard Business Review.
Like Harvard Business Review, like Sloan Management Review, like Forbes, like a New York Times op-ed.
You know, like a Marketing Book Podcast interview.
There you go, right? We can't pay you to get
that's
on.
Right. So, that's right. Although a bottle of wine, no, I'm kidding.
Oh, there you go.
No, but I know, yeah, it's earned. It's basically there's a gatekeeper there somewhere.
A gatekeeper,
right?
And a gatekeeper conveys, well, quality. We only publish quality. And then there's finally the paid channels. So search ads, banner ads, social media ads, pay-for-play conference presentations, advertorials. So I do not put down any of these channels. They will all extend your reach, the reach of your content, right, of your big idea.
And they work beautifully together.
Absolutely.
So when this, I'm just imagining this poor marketer trying to help a company with their thought leadership, and they say, okay, we've got it. Well, you know, now go run a Super Bowl ad. No. draw four circles on that whiteboard and explain right. this. And you said own, shared, earned, paid. I've also heard it described as peso. Paid, earned, shared, and owned. This was also talked yep. about in great detail in Jenny Dietrich's book, Spin Sucks. Mm. And so if you, and like you talked about how much traffic, you know, McKinsey or Harvard Business Review goes, it doesn't mean you can't start trying to build your own properties. Please
That's right.
don't build your, please don't build some, build a house on rented land. You really need to have all four of these. And just because you don't have the traffic of Harvard Business Review doesn't mean you can't get started. They all started at some point. So
that's right. That's right. And the less money, if you have a big idea, I believe it eventually will ripple through there. It's just going to take time, right?
Mm-hmm.
For people to find it out. And so folks who have bigger marketing budgets can make that, the recognition of your content, the readership of your content happen much faster, especially if they're paying for people to see your stuff, you know, Google
yeah.
AdWords that go up against the search term. So.
But it's like a diversified portfolio where you want to have, you know, all your bases covered in some way. And this is such a great model, and it's been talked about quite a bit, but too many companies seem to miss it. I want to ask one other quick question yep. before we wrap up, a couple others actually, if you don't
yep.
mind.
Sure.
Very important concept, and it reminded me of the model we talked about earlier in terms of complexity of problem and complexity of solution. You write on page 112, all thought leadership channels must be high bandwidth and low bias, okay? High yeah. bandwidth, low bias. I think this is really instructive. Explain the difference. Explain what that is, and also sure. the difference between high bandwidth, low bias channels and low bandwidth, high bias channels.
Absolutely. Okay, high bandwidth, low bias channel. So I can't take credit for this phrase. This phrase was coined by a consultant I work with back in the late 90s, Alan Cohen, who's a strategy and marketing consultant. This was Alan's beautiful phrase, high bandwidth, low bias. So high bandwidth channels are marketing channels in which the communicator can impart a lot of content. Okay, so a great example of a high bandwidth channel is a conference presentation, right? I have an hour to convince you that you should do this and not do that. Mm-hmm. Or a book, that my book or anybody's book, right? I've got 200 pages, 300 pages, 400 pages to convince you that this is the way to solve this problem. High bandwidth. I can impart a lot of information.
Right. And just so the listener knows, this book is not 400 pages.
Yes, no.
It's only 211.
Only 211, right.
So, and I think it's harder to write a short book, so thank you. Yeah, sure. But you know that you have the mental bandwidth of your audience.
Correct, you have the mental bandwidth. Now, to be able to compare this to low bandwidth channels, another high bandwidth channel in a magazine is an article, right? Is a Harvard Business Review or Sloan Management Review or Forbes article, right? They'll give you anywhere from typically 1,000 to, 4,000 words to convey your argument, okay? That's a high bandwidth channel. A low bandwidth channel would be advertising in that magazine, like a single page or even two pages. I can impart a lot of information in an advertisement, particularly if the advertisement has to be highly visual to catch the attention. Now, you could argue that advertorials are high bandwidth because they can be multiple pages in a magazine, and of course they are. But I would say an advertorial, because it says special advertising supplement, is a high bias channel. The reader already knows, this is an ad.
You're trying to sell me something.
Yeah, trying to sell me something. So that's high bias, okay? Yeah, high bandwidth, but high bias, okay? So the low bias channels, in contrast, are those that are not marked as special advertising supplements. The reader doesn't think he's being sold anything. He thinks, or she thinks, they're being educated.
Yes, okay? And I think readers, humans, are really good at sniffing out if they're trying to be sold to, more than a lot of companies and marketing efforts appreciate.
That's right, and which is one of the cardinal sins of thought leadership is when somebody in a terrific white paper, convinces you that they have a superior way to solve some problem, and at the end of the white paper it says, by the way, we have consulting services that solve this problem, and we'd love to talk to you about them. Okay, wait a second. You've already started to sell me. Please don't do that.
Yes.
You're reminding me, this is a biased channel. You're reminding me you're trying to sell me something. Okay.
I can just imagine that poor marketer in the conference room, she's trying to explain the concept and saying, no, this has to be low bias, boss.
Yes.
This has to be low bias. There's other places where we can be high bias, but we
That's
can't
right.
just be shilling. Yeah. So I thought that was such a great, another great framework for thinking about this. Let me jump ahead to just a couple other quick things here. At the very end of the book, you talk about turning company leaders into advocates for thought leadership. The right kind. And you're right. For every company I know that is fully bought into thought leadership and couldn't imagine operating as anything but a thought leader, I know of 10 others whose leaders remain skeptical about it. And you talk about thought leadership can only become a competitive advantage in organizations whose leaders are devoted to it. And then further down, page 178, you're right. In my experience, few B2B chief executives, other than those running professional services and research firms, companies whose clients pay them for their expertise, view thought leadership as vital to success. I appreciate your honesty. I was a little brought down by that, if we're going to talk about my feelings. But what's going on there? And there are still things that can be done to try to get more executive buy-in, because that's an important part, but also if you don't have the executive buy-in, I got the impression this really just never gets any traction.
Well, I have a theory that I guess I'd have to do research to prove. And we are going to be doing research this summer to see if it holds up. And the theory is that in many B2B sectors, probably outside of consulting and IT services, probably more in legal services, private equity firms, venture capital firms, even maybe in financial services, the theory is that the, let's call them the producers of thought leadership, you know, the McKinsey equivalents in those sectors, don't realize that their customers or target customers, the call them the consumers of thought leadership, value, they don't really understand how much the consumers, their customers, value thought leadership. Mm. That their customers value thought leadership a lot more than the producers value it. And I'm hoping that that research bears it out. Maybe it won't. But I think the management consulting industry has largely discovered that if we don't appear as thought leaders, we don't have books, we don't have Harvard Business Review and Sloan Review and other articles, and we're not getting op-eds in the Wall Street Journal, we're not giving speeches at the right places and all that stuff. If we don't have a great website, our version of McKinsey Quarterly, our clients will not view us as leading experts in our domains.
So why bother?
Oh. But I think the consulting industry largely gets that they have to do this. But other sectors I think are not there yet, mm-hmm. and so I'm not exactly sure why that there's so many skeptics at the top of so many B2B companies about this. And one hypothesis is that until you see thought leadership work, as I did way back at CSC Index, and I've seen at my firm's clients ever since then, until you see it actually generating leads and leads that turn into business and therefore revenue, until you actually have firsthand experience of what it's like to operate as a thought leader, you don't believe it. You don't believe it works.
Mm-hmm.
And you believe it's just a necessary expense that we have to control and minimize. Yeah, we have to have our white papers up there too.
We have to have a marketing department. You know.
Right. Yeah, we need a phone system. And
fax machine, maybe.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I need paintings on the wall. They're all bare.
So. Right, yeah. Free coffee for the employees.
Yes. And lights. We need lights.
Right. So. Yeah. Well, that would be very interesting research. I hope you all are able to do that. If folks go to your website, which I'm going to link to, is that something that you would publish in the future on your website?
Yes. We'll probably publish it starting in August or September.
Okay. Great.
We will be fielding the research in late April.
Okay.
And so
this is really going to happen.
Okay. I mean, right. We have to eat our own dog food, right? We need our own R&D. And we've done thought leadership. We probably have done 7 studies on thought leadership since 2008, I'm going to say. 2007.
Okay. So. Well, shoot. Now that I've read your book, you can't leave me hanging. Now.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
It would be that thought leadership is a competitive strategy, not just a marketing strategy. And companies that treat thought leadership as a competitive strategy will not have, won't only have superior marketing. More importantly, they're going to have better services and products that they bring to market. And it's the latter, those superior services and products, that is what generates value for their customer. Okay. The marketing doesn't generate value for the customer.
Right.
it's this re-engineering service that reduced our cost, 50% and our cycle time 80% and increased quality, 30%. It's the service that was marketed, not the marketing of the service that created the value for customers.
Yes. And that was one of the big things I learned from your book. So it's a great answer.
By the way, there's one other thing to learn from the book. that thought leadership can be the great equalizer, or a great equalizer, between large organizations and small ones, and between organizations that have been coasting for years on obsolete expertise and organizations that are hungry to eat their lunch and create new expertise.
Mm-hmm. And I think that also talks to one of the issues you said a lot of management might have is thinking, well, we can't compete with McKinsey and, you know, Deloitte and Accenture and so forth. Yes, you can.
Yes,
the
you
secret
can.
To getting ahead is getting started. Yes. And yes, you won't might not get the reach, but there was an expression in your book that I use all the time, the straw that stirs the drink. I pick up on any cocktail reference when I'm reading books. And the thought leadership is actually the straw that could help stir the product development and the management. So it's not so much about the marketing, is it how much better it makes you from a competitive standpoint, as you just mentioned.
And there's a great example of that, which I've written in an article published with two academics a couple of weeks ago in a publication called Entrepreneur and Innovation Exchange. And it's a case example of a venture capital firm that was founded in 2009, you know, decades after, you know, the early Silicon Valley venture capital firms were formed. So in 2009, Andreessen Horowitz went into business as a venture capital firm. My argument in that article was that on the back of thought leadership, especially an article in 2011, an op-ed they wrote that Mark Andreessen wrote for the Wall Street Journal, which was called Why Software is Eating the World, that on the back of thought leadership, Andreessen Horowitz went from an unknown venture capital firm very late in the game to the top tier of venture capital firms in just 13 years.
Wow.
I see that playing out, by the way, this decade with new law firms, new accounting firms, new consulting firms, new training and development firms, new architecture firms. If they compete on the basis of thought leadership, I believe, and they're well run, of course, they can come out of nowhere and you know, be vibrant and viable firms.
Absolutely. Well, is there something a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book, perhaps one that we've talked about, just to get them moving in the right direction until the book shows up?
Sure. One idea is for the chief marketing officer or chief executive officer who wants to understand the importance of thought leadership to their firm, you know, where they may be skeptical and, you know, it may look at it as a necessary evil and a cost to be minimized, is to go out and ask a dozen of their biggest customers how important thought leadership is to them and why.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah. You mean actually talk to humans?
Yes. The humans who write checks, right? That your business deposits. Right.
There was a line in your book, I underlined it, where you talked about it all comes down to interviewing people. I wanted to put that up on a wall somewhere because it's a easy thing to say, but there's something that keeps companies from just talking to their customers. And I don't mean saying, yes, what do you want? Just go talk to them.
Go talk to them.
Yeah.
You know, and the answers to those questions, I think, will be very telling. So a large professional services firm back in 2005, I think it was, or four, very large, I keep their name private, hired us. They wanted to improve their thought leadership programs, and they were spending a lot on it. But it was decentralized to a great degree, and they didn't think they were punching their weight. So they asked us to talk to 150 executives in the US and Europe about whether they read thought leadership material, what do they think about most of it, what constitutes good material, and how important it is in the way they run their business. How important is it to them? Hmm. And what we found by talking to, you know, to the consumers, so to say, of thought leadership was they don't get enough of it. Most of it is not very good. It's critical to the way they have made some big decisions on good thought leadership, some big and consequential multi-million dollar decisions, and they love it. And they want when it's good, and they want more of it. So,
wow, that sounds like an opportunity to me.
It is. I mean, you know, it's when, you know, I guess the people we should listen most who are our employees, and then and the people who pay the checks are customers.
Amen. Amen. And I think the employees are often more overlooked than the customers. Those employees know quite a bit if you want to take the time and listen to what they're seeing. A lot of times they'll share it and nothing's being done. It's kind of like, you know, we all have survey fatigue.
Yep.
It's like I get a survey from a company that I've had a terrible experience with, and I'm like, what are you going to do with it? I'm not going to waste my time with you. So,
exactly.
Bob, looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
So I see there are probably a half dozen books, and I read a lot of books. So the foremost one is Reengineering the Corporation, which I talk about in the book, and that was by Michael Hammer and Jim Champy. And Jim was the CEO of the firm I worked for at the time, CSC Index. That book embodied all nine hallmarks or criteria of thought leadership. I think it was John Byrne, who had worked at Business Week at the time and who runs something called Poets and Quants. He called it, his book review on Reengineering the Corporation was something like, this is the best business book written ever, something like that.
Hmm.
It was, Reengineering the Corporation has sold more than 2 million copies. It was on the New York Times bestseller list, general bestseller list, for 37 straight weeks back in 93 and 94. So an amazing book that whose principles, you know, precepts, ideas are still valid even almost 30 years later. Well argued, well supported with research, case study research, exceptionally well written. All right, so that's number one.
Yeah.
Next on the list are two books by Jim Collins, Built to Last. It was by Jim and Jerry Porras, and then Good to Great. Exceptional books, exceptional research, great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Third book is a much more recent book. It was co-authored by the co-founder of Netflix, Reed Hastings, and a corporate culture expert, Aaron Meyer. The book is called No Rules Rules. I think it was published in 2021, and it explained how Netflix and its culture, a very different culture than the typical media company culture, what it was as they saw it that enabled Netflix to be a pioneer in this digital streaming world.
No Rules Rules, Netflix and the Culture of Reinvention. Yeah.
Yeah. Great book. Great book. And you can see how traditional media companies like HBO, Viacom, you can see why they were late to the game in this world of streaming entertainment. It was, you read about the Netflix culture, and it's just fascinating.
Interesting.
And then the last book I'll mention is one of many books by Ram Charan. Ram was one of the 21 endorsers of my book. Ram is the CEO Whisperer. He wrote a book in 2013 called Global Tilt, Leading Your Business Through the Great Economic Power Shift. And in that book, it's Ram's view that the economic center of the world was shifting from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere, with southern hemisphere countries especially being China and India. And what leaders of companies in the northern world needed to do to remain competitive. Well argued, well written, another masterpiece by Ram Charan.
Interesting. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that one. Which is why I asked this question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Terrific. Well, are there any recent or maybe upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading or seeing come out?
Absolutely. So I have, six here, five. One is called, that I just bought, I haven't cracked open, but I read a review on it, which made it sound great. It's called The Power Law, Venture Capital in the Making of the New Future by Sebastian Mallaby. It's history of the venture capital industry, especially Silicon Valley.
Oh, interesting.
So that sounds interesting to me.
Uh-huh.
A book by John Doerr, who works at an old venture capital firm in Silicon Valley called Kleiner Perkins John is a partner there. He recently published a book with some co-authors called Speed and Scale. And that's about what business and government can do to address climate change. And it's I've begun to read that book. It is it looks like an encyclopedia. This book is an incredible book, and it's just hard to describe why it's incredible, but it's just a book to be seen and read.
Yeah, interesting. I see that it's got stories from Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Al Gore. Interesting.
Yeah, it's a serious book. There's another book that's in that genre that I recommend by a good friend of mine and his two co-authors. It's called A History of a Perfect Future by Chunka Moy, Paul Carroll, and Tim Andrews. And it's about what businesses can do to help hopefully reverse the climate change that's going on.
A brief history of
a perfect
future, inventing the world we can proudly leave our kids by 2050.
That's it.
Interesting. Yep.
Now, there's a fourth book that we were involved in editing. It's by a black woman executive named Astor Angagaw. She just got a big job at Amazon. The book is called "We Are So Much More: Integrating the Seven Dimensions of Success for Women Leaders to Thrive at Work and at Life." And she interviews, I think it's 20 women, and talks about her own life in women who have risen to leadership jobs in big companies and what they had to do to make sure they didn't ruin the rest of their lives, how they balanced, family and community. And so I would advise anybody with young daughters, teenage daughters, daughters in college, daughters earlier in their careers to read this book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Guess who's going to buy a copy for his daughter, who is a 24-year-old executive in New York City. We Are So Much More: Integrating the Seven Dimensions of Success for Women Leaders to Thrive at Work and in Life. Well, that looks like a winner.
Oh, it's a great book, and she
and you all contributed to it.
We edited it. These are Astor had talk about frameworks. She has a great framework, these seven dimensions, and she interviewed all these 19 or 20 women, and she also, of course, told her own story. She was Ethiopian. That's where she grew up, and then she moved to the U.S. at a young age, and she just needed some polish editing work. Her ideas were so strong. Her interviews were great, and her narrative was excellent. So we helped her in a very minor way, And it's a great book. It's also a book for I would argue for men. When I read the book, I read her manuscript. I thought, you know, Bob, you got to make sure you're balancing more of these dimensions here, you know?
I think I may have it delivered to my house, and I'll read it, then I'll send it to her. Yeah.
Yes, you should buy two copies or something.
But, that's right.
It's a great book. And then a book that will come out, I'll mention this book, next year that we're involved in, and this will sound like self-promotional, and maybe it is. But
so that would be high bias, right?
High bias. This is high bias. It's high bandwidth, but it's high bias.
Okay.
But I truly think, well, even if we were not involved, I would be touting this book. The title is To Be Determined. It's a book by the founder and president of a moving company that's based in Boston. It's called Gentle Giant Moving Company. It's a national company now. It's about a $50 million revenue company. Larry founded it in the early – Larry O'Toole is the founder, an Irishman who came over as a teenager. And he is one of the most remarkable business executives I have ever met. And his book is part memoir and part managerial advice for managers of similar companies. They don't have just to be moving companies. They can be any service organization in which you have people who are in physically demanding jobs, who are working at the front lines with customers, who are often at an emotional moment in their lives. So you think about moving, right? It's one of the most emotionally draining part of any of our lives.
Absolutely.
Right? And so Larry is a remarkable person, and his family is remarkable. His mother, his 96-year-old mother, who lives in the U.S., she's from Ireland as well, she just published a book. And it's about a famous Irish poet named Patrick Kavanagh, who came to live with Larry and his dad and his mother and his siblings back in the early 60s when they were all back in Ireland, who showed up at their door down and out. The father knew Patrick Kavanagh, and they took him in for months, I think 6 months or so. And they nurtured him back to health and got him back on his feet. So I think it's called A Poet in the House. You can find it online. So his mother published her first book at age 96. Okay. So Larry's father was a playwright. He worked for an electric utility in Ireland, and he was a playwright who wrote a play about how large businesses could destroy the morale. We're destroying the morale of people, and we're not always working in the best interests of their communities. So his father was a writer too, and he was a professor. I think he taught scientific communications at Northeastern University or Boston University. Larry's got a sister, Margot, who was a whistleblower. Back in the 90s, you can read about her. Just search Margot O'Toole, whistleblower, and you'll read about her. So Larry comes from an Irish family. And Larry's book, which, you know, next year, is Larry has incredible stories to tell from Ireland, things he learned from his grandfather, his father, his mother, and others, and things he
has.
Well,
if you're Irish, aren't you a natural-born storyteller anyway?
I guess you are.
It's Irish law.
It is Irish law. And Larry is, the way Larry treats his employees, by the way, they're all employees. They're not contract workers, which is unusual, apparently, in the moving industry, where they're using a lot of contract workers. Larry, you know, they're employees. They pay benefits. Larry pays them well. Larry trains them well. Larry, respect is a core element of his company's culture. Respect for the customer, respect for, you know, your fellow movers who are moving people out and into their homes. Larry is the most humane CEO I have come across in my, you know, 40 years in working in business. The most humane CEO I have ever met.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, as we're talking, I'm bringing up the Wikipedia page for his company. And there's some videos I did not know about him. This sounds really interesting. It almost sounds like it's a script someone would write, a screenplay, and they would say, "Nah, that's not realistic enough. That's not logical." Yes. Yeah, that's terrific.
Larry explains how you can create a fast-growing and profitable business not on the back of your employees. You know, meaning, you know, taking a pound of flesh out of them. But actually by paying them well, treating them well, building a culture that they can thrive in and move up as leaders, an environment in which they can thrive, and how you can have a very successful business in an industry that may look to be a commodity, like moving. Like, you know, isn't that a commodity service? Not the way Larry O'Toole has been running his business for 40 plus years.
What a significant differentiator.
Yeah.
I hired a moving company recently when we gave up our offices because we all had to go virtual. And I hadn't hired movers for years. It was a good experience, but I just remember thinking, you know, that it was very much a commodity thing. So, well, that is great. What a great list of books. And at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable from this conversation, including all the books that you've mentioned, your site, your LinkedIn profile, and your Twitter account. And a word to you, dear listener, I want to ask you a big favor. And it's, believe it or not, from a podcaster, it's not for a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Although if you do, please let me know and I'll send you a small thank you in the mail anywhere in the world. And if you want to send me a bottle of wine, please, you know, some listeners have done that. That's fine too. But seriously, what I want you to do is to reach out to Bob in some way. You can connect with him on Twitter, LinkedIn, go to his website, but please congratulate him on this book. Thank him for spending so much time with us today on the Marketing Book Podcast. This conversation went a little longer than they normally do, but it's been a real pleasure, and his book was is so illuminating. If you can avoid going to his house initially, that would be good, because that really... Yeah, this is a very enthusiastic audience, and let's not do that right off the bat, okay? But if nothing else, please reach out and just thank him for being a guest on the podcast. Congratulate him on the book. And seriously, the guests who've been on the show have told me later that they get the biggest kick out of hearing from people who listen to the interview. And if you have a question, ask Bob. I mean, you don't have to be a Penn State grad to get an answer. He's probably going to answer.
Although I'll give a discount. I'll give a discount to Penn State grads.
Oh, okay. Okay. There you go. There you go. That's great. Yeah. So if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. And since we've gone so long, I can't resist. Just a couple of final quotes. One from page 197. I hope you now see that it's not just a marketing activity to be done alongside brand and product marketing. It's not just publishing best-selling books or groundbreaking articles in prestigious journals. It's not just a way for salespeople to do consultative selling. Rather, competing on thought leadership is a firm's strategy to outthink, outmarket, and outdeliver expertise that solves its clients' problems. It's about accelerating revenue and profit by developing superior expertise, getting target clients to embrace it, and delivering it at a level of quality that competitors can't match. But wait, there's more. Page 211. The number of business problems for companies to solve for the rest of this decade will be endless. The firms with the best expertise will win big. So will the people who can help their firms develop, become recognized for, and deliver that expertise. The book is Competing on Thought Leadership, How Great B2B Companies Turn Expertise into Revenue. The author is Bob Boudet. Bob, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you, Douglas. Great questions, and I thoroughly enjoyed our time.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."